the format for how this last session is going to be handled. Each of our speakers will read a question that's related to their area, and then they will give an answer. If someone else on the panel wants to jump in, they can add their input as well. And we'll just do it on a rotating basis. Each one can go down, and we'll try to cover as many questions as we can that have been turned in. If there does happen to be some more time left at the end, perhaps we can field some questions from the audience then, but I don't envision that because we have a pretty good stack of questions up here. So without any further delay, I'm going to turn it over to them, and Dr. Wise can start by reading his question and then giving the answer.
Who chose who to give these questions to? That's what I want to know.
I think it was by default here.
Okay. While creation scientists continue to make notably newsworthy advances in the origin, in the understanding of origins, I can't read. The scientific and educational communities in the news media still, for the most part, refuse to give any credibility to creationism. For example, witness the mockery received by the Kansas Board of Education when they allowed creation to be taught in schools alongside evolution. What will need to happen for creationism to make inroads in evolutionary teachings in school and in the media? A miracle. Next. Wow. I mean that. I think that Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 20 talk about God showing himself in the creation to such an extent that people are left without excuse. But then verse 21 goes ahead and says, but when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. I would suggest that it is the natural state of man to run from the God to whom he is accountable. The unbeliever does not want to be accountable to God. So I do not see a reasonable way to assume that the unbelieving world, as long as it dominates academia, is going to be happy with a creationist perspective. Because as soon as you elevate or glorify the God of creation, you also uphold and you point to the one to whom they're accountable. And they don't like that. I mean, I have trouble with that sometimes. It's difficult enough for me. So I do not believe that there's anything that can make this happen aside from God's miraculous intervention, transforming the hearts of individuals to such a point, and enough of the culture, so the culture itself becomes conducive to this. I don't see anything happening to any other way to do it.
Okay, my question is, have Mount St. Helens rocks been dated? If so, what were the results? Okay.
Where do you take a rock on a date? What were the results of that?
We know they like rock music. Okay. But don't know where you take a rock on a date. Okay, have Mount St. Helens rocks been dated by radioisotope techniques? I would think that's the question. The answer is yes. I dated the lava dome at Mount St. Helens. And about 1996, I collected a rock from the center of the dome in Mount St. Helens. It was a fresh lava flow that had flowed over the surface of the dome 11 years before. So I got 11-year-old lava flow rock that came out of a crack in that lava dome, and that's what I submitted for potassium-argon analysis. And I submitted it blind to the laboratory. The laboratory didn't know that I was giving them 11-year-old rock.
It's a blind date?
It's a blind date, yes. So that that rock was dated at 350,000 years, plus or minus 50,000. Okay, and then, so I was very interested in the mineral phases of the rock to know what is the mineral phase of this whole rock, that the whole rock was what we dated, and it was argon, potassium argon technique. So where is that argon, excess argon, that was there 11 years ago? Where, what mineral phase is that residing in? So what I did was a very tedious process of separating out the minerals using heavy liquids and magnetism, and then I sent some of those mineral separates into the laboratory, I think four or five different separates, and that we got mineral phases up to 2.8 million years old. And it turns out orthopyroxene is the name of a mineral that's in the lava dome at Mount St. Helens, and it's loaded with argon. It didn't leak out when the lava flow cooled 11 years ago, or 11 years before I collected it. So so we got up to 2.8 million years on a 11-year-old lava flow. So can dates be off by enormous quantities? The answer is yes. And potassium argon dating is notorious for giving old ages, especially on recent lavas. A good example is Mount Etna. Hawaiian lava flows often give old ages. Trying to think of Mount Lassen, some others. I haven't dated anything else at Mount St. Helens, but those are the primary results. And a ranger came up to me and shook my hand and said, "Steve, aren't you the guy that dated the lava dome at Mount St. Helens is 2.8 million years old?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I want to congratulate you on that fine work." Anyway, so it's not the kind of thing you want to remember. I put on my tombstone, he dated the lava dome at Mount St. Helens or something.
Your wife wouldn't like that.
No. Okay. That's the answer, so.
All right. That's why you should court. I have been taught that the Pentateuch was written by several authors over a period of time as evidenced by differing languages, Semitic and Hebrew. I'm not sure exactly. Was it really written by one? Why is this refuted? The internal evidence of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament, as well as the evidence of the New Testament, points to the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch, with very minor editorial additions, perhaps the last couple of chapters in after the Song of Moses, of the chapter or whatever. Moses himself would have had revelation from God and could have had written sources as well with respect to the events before his time, but he's still the one who by inspiration put it together. The Pentateuch is written in Hebrew. There are no other Semitic languages involved in the first five books of the Old Testament. What happened because of unbelief coming out of German higher criticism was an attempt to spread the Pentateuch over the history of Israel, actually going back to the evolution of religion. And so wanting to there was a Jehovah author, priestly authors, and like that. And thus, the Pentateuch was supposed to have been written over the period of the development of Israel. And of course, that is, again, growing out of a reaction against the supernatural, against prophecy, against the inerrant nature of the Word of God. Unfortunately, today, many of the men that are even teaching in our more conservative schools have trained in places where they've not been exposed to the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch and the arguments for it. They really are overwhelming. And so they get exposed to the critical arguments, and we're hearing things like, well, it was an essential Mosaic authorship, or Moses wrote some, but an inspired editor finished out the work. But I believe the Bible's testimony is to the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch, and I believe that's where we should camp.
What is the best way for a biology or geology student to pursue his study in the secular university setting? How should a creationist conduct himself or herself? You did give me hard ones. The best way for a biology or geology student to pursue his study in the secular university setting, to conduct themselves, I think the answer to that is you conduct yourself as Christ. And I don't mean that lightly. I believe Jesus himself was a person who was aware of his environment. He responded to the needs of the people about him. He was very sensitive to the needs of the people about him. He saw his primary function being a spiritual one, as a doctor for people in need. And therefore, I think the primary function of a believer in any setting, no matter whether you're in a secular university setting or whether you're at home or whether you're in your neighborhood, whether you're at work, is to be sensitive to the needs of the people about you and meet those needs. To maintain your relationship with the Lord in such a way that you can allow him to meet the needs of the people around you. And if those needs are physical, if they need a sandwich, give them a sandwich. If they have a need of salvation, give them the gospel. If they have any, whatever their need is, meet them. That doesn't change when you go into secular academia. And when you do that, it's going to alleviate a lot of the problems that a lot of people automatically have. If your focus is to meet the needs of the people about you, you're not going to... We have problems with some people getting in there and being antagonistic and getting into antagonistic relationships and so on and so forth. And I think if you see your primary function as meeting the needs of people around you, that will lessen significantly. At the same time, I was taught when I was going up towards graduate school that what I was supposed to do with regards to creationism is keep that silent. That I was told, and I was told this over and over again in public settings and in private by leading creationists, that you don't want to let people know that you believe in creation, because they won't pass you in your courses, they won't give you a degree. If they give you a degree, they won't give you a recommendation for graduate school. If they get into graduate school, they won't let you pass your orals. If they let you pass your orals, they won't give you a PhD. If you get that, they won't give you a recommendation to go into a job. If you get into a job, you're going to not get tenure. And every step along the way, it will not be possible for a creationist to get advanced. That's what I was told. And I was told that very, very straightforwardly, definitively, and I, for a time, believed it. Until one day, I was sitting in class with my professor, with his back to me, writing on the board. I'll never forget this day. And it's one of those days where, if you're a believer, you've felt this. Felt like God kind of knocked me off the side of the head and said, hey, you need to witness to that guy. And I sat down. Now, I know you're more spiritual than I, those of you who are believers among you. You didn't do what I did at that particular point. I sat there and started arguing with him. I can't do that, God. This is my professor. He's still got that ability to give me an A or a B or a C or a D or an F and this sort of thing. And by the way, if I tell him about God, he's probably going to find out I'm a creationist. And if he finds out a creationist, I'm never going to get a bachelor's degree, and I can't then get a PhD. And that's what, you know, that's how you're going to use me, God. So I can't do that. And God hit me again real hard. Because I looked back at him, that man, with his back to me on the board, and I thought, wait a minute, what am I doing? Am I willing to sacrifice this man's soul to go into hell just for a piece of paper? Just for a piece of sheepskin? I couldn't do that. And all of a sudden I realized that that recommendation that I've been given was effectively a suggestion to keep my witness, the gospel, under a basket. And so I changed at that point. I said to the Lord, right there in that seat, at that very moment, I said, I realize now, God, which I didn't realize before, that if you want me to get a PhD from Harvard University, from under Stephen Jay Gould, who is an anti-creationist and all of that, that you can make it happen even if everybody knows I'm a creationist. Because that's what you're in the business of doing. Like Steve said earlier today, the business of the impossible. And I then trusted that if you want me in that position, God, and then what I need to do is meet the needs of the people I've got around me, and I'll leave it in your hand how you're going to use me. If you want me to have a PhD, that'll happen. If you don't want me to have a PhD, that'll be fine. Whatever you want to have happen. And so I decided that day I was not going to cover the light of my gospel. And so my fellow students, my professors knew in my undergraduate curriculum, they decided to withhold that information when they made recommendations to Steve Gould, and they gave positive recommendations to Steve Gould. So Steve accepted me into the program, learning about it before I actually went out and got on campus. And then knowing that I was a creationist, I passed the orals. Knowing I was a creationist, when it comes around to looking around for places to go, Steve offered to give me a letter of recommendation saying he would be willing to even withhold the information that I was a creationist if he thought that would improve my likelihood of getting a job. Now, if that isn't a miracle, I don't know what is, but that's the kind of God we have. I would suggest that you seek first the kingdom of God, and all these other things will be added unto you.
Amen.
Well, these are great questions. If 900 cubic miles of sediment eroded from Grand Canyon, could not you find it or some evidence of it downstream?
These people are thinking.
Yeah,
they
boy.
Listen to you.
Okay, so the other end of the story is my backyard in California, in the salt and trough, and in the deserts of San Diego County, is this immense trough of sediment that's 5 miles deep. That's a very recent delta from the Colorado River, where the modern Colorado River sits on top. It sits there. And the 900 cubic miles or 1,000 cubic miles or so of sediment is sitting there, but there's no deeply buried delta under it with a long time history going back to the Cretaceous, the time of the dinosaurs. So what is amazing is the recency of the establishment of the delta of the Colorado River into the lower Colorado River drainage basin in direct confirmation, essentially, of the catastrophic drainage model. And, then how could the Colorado Plateau exist for 70 million years without a through-flowing river system established over it? So evolutionists use time as the hero of the plot, right? They use time to solve all their problems. They got a big problem, too much time. That's their problem. And so time is not the hero of the plot, it's the villain of the plot when you're looking at the Colorado Plateau and Grand Canyon erosion, I would say.
So you've not only got the smoking gun, you've got the bullet in the wall.
Okay, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
So. Here we go with our analogies again.
Please elaborate on the apparent contradiction between Genesis 10:5 and Genesis 11:1. 10:5, after we get this introduction to Shem, Ham and Japheth, and then we get the sons of Japheth were the sons of Gomer, etc. From these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. And then, of course, 11:1, now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. Well, there's no contradiction there. The genealogy in Genesis 10 is going down past the Tower of Babel, and thus it is anticipating, as it accounts in this genealogical form, the subsequent generations and descendants. And then in 11, we go back to find out how these different languages developed, because, of course, all coming from Noah, they would have spoken the same language until the tongues were divided at Babel, and then the nations were dispersed. So it's a spiritual example of what Dr. Wise pointed out earlier, again, in God's pre-planning. this was going to happen, and then he used the rebellion at Babel to cause it to happen.
Isn't it also true, I've heard that it's typical in Hebrew narrative to begin the narrative with a genealogy, for example, the genealogy of 5, Genesis 5, that leads into the flood, the genealogy of 10, which leads into the Babel, genealogy of 11, that leads into Abram.
Right. And I'm going to deal with that tomorrow, in fact. But 11 is part of, 11:1 is part of the genealogy of 10. But that's also another point, because you get recapitulations as you get transitions.
Ouch.
What kind of future scenario do you envision for the modern creation movement?
Ooh, boy.
I tell you, I have said before, I continue to say, that there, in my opinion, there cannot be a more exciting time to be a young earth creationist than right now. Don't you think we have fun,
yes,
Steve? I mean,
yes,
we're having a ball. Got to get him to smile every once in a while. The creation theories that are coming out at very high rate. There are very few of us, but they're coming out at a very high rate. There's exciting things. It seems like every time we turn around, there's something else exciting. There are too many things to do with too few people and too little money, but that means that we're having an awful lot of fun doing it. And so I see, at least for the near future, and I say within the next, I'd say painting the next 15 years, that there is, if you wish, it's a job market with no money, but there's an open set of positions. There are so many needs in so many fields for experts across the board in creationism. There's a need for geochemists. There's a need for more paleontologists, biologists, astronomers, general relativists, linguists, archaeologists, climatologists. You list the field, not just in the sciences, but in the biblical studies, and in philosophy, and in culture studies, and in archaeology, all of these things, we have need of people. And every time we get a new graduate student who comes up and picks because of their dissertation a particular field, they are the world's expert because they're the only one. And they have a great amount of fun developing theories in a brand new field. Because in spite of the fact that creationism is not a new idea, the idea of interpreting the world on the assumption that the Bible is true as written is unfortunately a relatively new phenomenon within the last few centuries. Shouldn't be, but it is. And so it's a wide open field, terribly, terribly exciting for anybody who happens to get into it. And so I see the movement, because I see so many more graduate students coming in and getting doctorates in various fields. I see the movement increasing getting better and better and more exciting. I guess it's sort of like a picture of the church in general. The church has often thrived when it is the most persecuted, and actually not just exists and thrives, but actually increases in number. Look at China. Look at the Chinese church. Extraordinary what's happened. I guess I really fear for 25 years from now, when perhaps we have so many in here in creationism that the quality begins to atrophy, which many times happens when Christianity flourishes. Right now, though, we're in a period of duress, and I think because of that, natural selection or unnatural selection takes out the all but the best, and we have some fantastic folks working in a variety of fields doing some really neat work. Really fun time. Young people, even old people, you interested in getting into some field in creationism, do it. Fun stuff. Have lots of fun.
My question here is, if water goes to the lowest point, why would a small river in a large canyon roam from side to side to cut the additional width? And it's that's a profound question too. I think what the questioner is recognizing is that many floodplains of rivers are a lot wider than the natural river would in size. And that's been shown in a number of cases. Probably the most spectacular example is a dry coulee in Washington called Grand Coulee. It's a 50-mile-long trench. It's about 2 miles wide, 900 feet deep. And it had virtually no river flowing or creek flowing down through it, yet it appears to have been eroded in solid rock. And that's a canyon without a river. Now there are a lot of most canyons have small rivers in them, and the good examples are ones at Mount St. Helens to remind us about how water or potent energy or potent energy sources in the past may have eroded canyons. A good example is the Mississippi River, especially up Ohio River up that way. The river appears to be underfit with respect to its valley. And this whole thing about underfitness is very important. And it, as you look at the Colorado River, you can see it's underfit relative to its canyon. For example, even in the Grand Canyon, the channel is lined with a huge mass of boulders that are sitting in the course of the river. It builds up these rapids and things. Well, the water does not flood fast enough to erode the boulders that are lining the channel, and so the channel is not getting wider and not going down. In other words, it's a relic or a monument, and a lot of geologists appreciate the fact that landscape evolution has been essentially turned off, and as you look at valleys, you see this idea of underfit rivers, and so an underfit river was flowing a lot more water in the past, especially associated with Ice Age drainage. Most geologists are willing to admit, at least in the glaciated areas, the idea of underfit rivers. In the tropics, though, it's a little bit harder to get along with. But I think there's plenty of evidence of underfitness. So the present is not the key to the past. The present may be the keyhole to the past, or something like that. And so you need to. That's why we need Mount St. Helens to help us think about canyon erosion. I hope I did justice to that question.
Is there biblical evidence that animal behavior was changed at the time of the fall? And then the questioner asked about Genesis 6, where it says that all flesh was corrupted. Let's see. 12. And God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Can we conclude that animals are included since the Hebrew is the word all flesh? Well, I don't think we can prove that from Genesis 6, because earlier in verse 3, you have to take that all flesh in its context. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. So I think here the corrupting of oneself has to do with the sinful nature given over to hardness of sin. But again, as Dr. Wise showed us in the last hour, animals were radically affected by the fall, as Paul teaches us in Romans 8, that the whole entire creation was subjected to futility. And I personally believe, as I believe, that's when the animals then developed a carnivorous nature, was after the fall. Genesis 1 says that they ate, as did man, of the seeds of the plants, the grass of the earth. And so there was a change in animal nature, and by the time of the flood, animals were, again, anticipated to become no longer afraid of man, but would become themselves increased predators. And thus, at that time, God institutes the death penalty against animals as well as men for taking the life of men. So yes, animals, I believe, were grossly affected by the fall. But I don't think that's what's necessarily said in Genesis 6:3. One of the problems that conservatives have today is animal death. And you'll hear them saying that they believe that animal death was natural before the fall. Violent animal death. I'll be agnostic on animal death. There's nothing in itself that would be wrong about an animal dying more than a plant dying, a natural death. But violent animal death before sin entered the world, I think, is a total corruption of the Bible. And that's exactly what you have in every one of the non-literalist approaches to Genesis chapter 1, because they're trying to reconcile with the fossil record, and thus they're claiming that there was violent animal death before the fall. And I think that is wrong. I think that began after the fall.
Here's a tough one. How to handle creation science versus science, those in quotes, debate in public arena, for example, in the school boards. Oh, I'm probably the worst person to give this to for my position on these things, my outspoken position on these things. Let's just take the school board situation as a case in point, and let me generalize it to, I think, I'm going to make the claim that Christians, in my opinion, have not behaved themselves in many cases in a seemly manner in the political arena. I think, and this is in general, the way they are perceived to deal with the abortion situation, the way they're perceived to deal with a variety of issues. There are some that I believe are dealing with it very well. For example, those who might, on the abortion issue, set up an alternative, let's say next door to an abortion clinic, where people will adopt, you put the rubber to the road and put that love into effect, where you give an alternative to folks that are inclined to go towards abortion for whatever reason. On the other hand, there are those people within Christianity, at least who claim to be part of Christianity, who actually go around and kill abortion doctors, those who perform abortions, seeing that that's justified, saying that that's justified. And I think those of us who are believers recognize that there are those who are acting like Christ, and there are those who are in Christ who aren't acting like Christ. And that, I believe, happens within the creation science movement as well. I believe there are proper ways to deal politically with the issue of creation versus evolution, but most of the ways that become well known in the media are not necessarily good ways. And for example, on the issue of putting creationism into the public schools, it is my outspoken position, and others here, panel, can disagree if they wish, that I do not believe we have a good curriculum of creationism available to give to the schools if we ever wanted to encourage them to put creationism into the schools. I do not think the evolution curriculum is good, is a high quality curriculum. Steve Gould agrees with me on this. He is not happy, nor are most evolutionists happy, with the quality of education of evolution in the schools. Quality of education is poor. The curriculum is poor. They don't have a better curriculum to put in there, so they're upset and frustrated. I feel we're in the same position in creationism. In my opinion, we do not have a good curriculum to put into the schools if it's really needed and desired. Therefore, I'm not too happy with people that try to push to get creation into the schools. I'm frustrated by the fact that we don't have anything to give them. And until we do, I'm not going to be too happy with those who are trying to push it. Also, to require teachers, I am against requiring teachers to present creationism for a number of reasons. One is, the last thing I want is for an unbeliever who hates God and hates anything to do with God, to force them to teach creation. I think it would be far better that you just let them not deal with the issue at all than to massacre creationism and publicly humiliate our students because they're forced to teach creation. Also, I feel what we need to do is teach our teachers how to teach, how, give them the material, give them the information they need, and it's our responsibility to give them what they need to teach well, not to tell them what to teach. I am very much against requiring or legislating what teachers should be teaching. I think what we need to do is give them good information and trust that we have trained our teachers in such a way they can discern what is good and what is bad, and they can teach well when they have good information. So as a result, I've been against, historically, every single attempt on a political level to push creationism, because I think it, and I'm told I was responsible for the killing of the bill back in 1996 in Tennessee, the creation bill there, because of my position on these things. And I think it behooves us, by the way, this should tell us we have a lot of work to do. We don't have a curriculum. We need a curriculum. We need to develop a curriculum. We need to develop a high-quality curriculum, one that I would not be at all embarrassed to share with any teacher, secular or Christian, and get that into the schools. But we currently do not have such a thing. So I think it behooves us to do our work, put together such curriculum, taking the things we have in creationism, creating a good model, a good curriculum, and then offering that information to the teachers. And I don't think you have to legislate it. In fact, I'm against the legislation.
Let me piggyback. I from a different angle, but enforcing what Dr. Wise has said, and I remember what he pointed out this morning, but ultimately we're dealing with faith issues here. And I personally think that one cannot divorce what these men are doing with constructs from revelation in terms of true creation science. And so when he says he doesn't want a non-Christian teacher teaching these things out of a bias against God, that's a very important thing to realize. But I'll take it a step further then and simply challenge some of you that maybe need to be challenged in this way. Don't waste your time or your money on the state schools. I'm sure there's some state teachers here, and forgive me. I don't judge your conscience. You know, if that's where you feel God calls you to be, that's between you and God. But in terms of a movement, that'd be like trying to go into a pagan temple and teach monotheism. State education is a religious system, as everything in the culture. And statism is diametrically opposed to God and the Bible. And I know in the South we're blessed to have many Christian teachers and many sympathetic principles, and that's good. And thus our schools in many cities are not as bad as they can be. But I think now's the time really to put our resources into excellence in education in Christian schools. Or if a person is called to homeschool, to do that, but do that well, rather than try to get prayer into the public school or creation science into the public school. I think our time would better be spent. That's not saying you can't teach there, but our time we better spend, I think, putting our resources into a consistent alternative.
Okay, the question I have is, can you speak regarding the Ice Age and where it fits in catastrophic thinking? Maybe compare and contrast with uniformitarian views of the Ice Age. The Ice Age has long been a mystery, but I would say it fits very nicely into the overall creation, fall, flood, post-flood framework of the Scripture. If Noah's flood was global and involved a great tectonic upheaval, the fountains of the Great Deep breaking up, continents ripping apart, ocean floor being subducted, new ocean floor forming volcanically. If we had 10,000 new seamounts in the Pacific Ocean floor, and we got all these volcanoes going off, this kind of thing is just loaded with heat. Okay, and one of the byproducts of Noah's flood is going to be heat. And what do you have to have an ice age? Everybody knows one of the two things you need. It's cold, right? You need to have cold. But the other thing you need to have is water vapor. And how do you get water vapor in the atmosphere to create ice and snow? Heat. So you need increased evaporation of ocean waters, and you need the condensation of the ocean waters over the continent. Precipitation is ice. So you need warm, humid air over the oceans, and you need dry, cold air over the continents. What happens after Noah's flood? The climatic picture changes. You got all this leftover heat. The Arctic Ocean may have been 30 degrees centigrade when Noah got out of the ark. Imagine that. What's it going to be like up in that prairie steppe habitat in Alaska? Animals would just thrive, like, 6 months of sun next to a warm ocean. That's a wonderful habitat. Without a significant freeze, that's a wonderful habitat. What happened is the earth cooled off, and now we live in an arid earth. We live in a cooler, arid earth relative to the pre-flood, which was a warm, humid earth. So that's the typical scenario. How does this fit into biblical chronology? I think the Ice Age is associated with the time of the Tower of Babel, about that time. Okay, people were distributed widely, and about that time, sea level was lower, and animals are leaving the ark and distributing widely over the earth. Men decide to stay in one place. And so during this time, sea level was about 300 to 400 feet lower globally, okay, and all these land bridges are exposed, and so people could be dispersed widely through, across into North America. And so this is one of the most fantastic things about creation theory, is it predicts an ice age. And almost a necessary outgrowth of a global flood is what? An ice age. And so it just naturally comes. Now, think about the uniformitarian trying to explain why we have this unique climatic epoch just recently, after a large period of time without glaciation. That's a tough one. And what caused the ice age? The uniformitarians really don't have a good explanation for it. But the flood is an ideal explanation for the ice age and the aftermath of the flood. There's been some climatic modeling using global climate model, the standard climate model that's been used to model what the earth is like after the flood. If you have a warm ocean or warm ocean over mid-ocean ridges and warm polar ocean, it creates a natural circulation system and a lot of rain and snow. So it's very beneficial. The other thing that this generates is what are called hypercanes. You've heard of a hurricane. Well, you guys in North Carolina know what hurricanes are. We in California never have those. But a gigantic hurricane is called a hypercane. And these climate models essentially predict hypercanes, which are these high-intensity hurricanes that sit in one place, essentially dousing the continental area with snow or water. And that might explain the buildup of ice in Canada and why parts of Siberia and Alaska weren't even glaciated at all. So there's a lot of things to be explained here, and I think there's really a lot of encouragement that we might offer for creationists getting into the Ice Age phenomenon. By the way, who was the first scientist to generate the Ice Age theory? Well, Carpentier convinced Louis Agassiz, who convinced Buckland. If you know the history involved here, it's about 1830 through about 1837 that the catastrophist geologists were generating the understanding of the boulder deposits in Europe. And so that's how the Ice Age theory was developed. And Louis Agassiz, who went to Harvard University, he was a catastrophist and a creationist. Anyway, Agassiz developed the understanding of glacial geology here on the North American continent, and other generation of geologists followed him. Who was the last people to accept the idea of an ice age? It was Charles Lyell's uniformitarian school that were the last to be convinced of an ice age, because it is a very singular, severe climatic event, and trying to explain that is why. Well, all those mammoths in Siberia and Alaska, frozen, okay, and you can imagine what the what that habitat was like right after the flood, and these animals just had a wonderful time in this new habitat that they discovered, and as they dispersed into the polar areas, they just found the sanctuary they needed. But when the ice age diminished, and when the oceans cooled off, and when the continents warmed up, and you got this difference in temperature extreme ameliorated, then that's when the ice age quit. So what caused the ice age to melt off? The evolutionists have no answer. The creationists have the ideal answer. So everything is in creationist favor for what stopped the ice age. Now, evolutionists are baffled by how rapidly deglaciation occurred. They're talking about Canadian ice sheet melting on extreme dimensions, so much so that it it cut the straits going out of Hudson Bay into the Northern Atlantic Ocean. Some extreme underfitness to the major river systems like Mississippi, St. Lawrence, and Mackenzie River, and all this. So there's just wonderful room for explanations of rapid deglaciation in creation models. So could you imagine an ice age lasting 1,000 years? I think easily it could fit in there. Are there multiple glaciations? I think there's probably stages of ice advance or stages of ice retreat, but probably not five different ice sheets that melted off completely the Canadian Shield and then more ice came back. So the uniformitarian models haven't really dealt with the evidence very well, and I think the creationists can see this new way of thinking. At ICR, we have Dr. Larry Vardaman, who is doing climatic modeling on computer, actually using climate models. And he has a student who's done various climate models on ocean temperature regimes. Another student has just taken over the hypercane research and generating these unusual storm systems. So it looks like it's really a victory area for creation thinking. And this may explain Ice Age Man, you know, in Israel and down in the climate change since the time of Abraham. You know, the whole climate regime of the Middle East has changed, and of course, Egypt. So all of this is just wonderful, fertile ground for creationist thinking. And if there's ever was a great thing to go into with a creationist paradigm system, it's just taking the framework of Scripture and looking at what's going on with the Ice Age. Wonderful, wonderful endeavor.
Great.
Genesis 6:4 speaks about the Nephilim. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God came in the daughters of men and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. There you also find about the Nephilim in Numbers 13:33. And so the question is, if you had a universal flood, how did the Nephilim come back? Well, I personally think that Nephilim is just a generic name for either outlaws and bandits, perhaps also men that were of super large stature, but probably just robbers, and more of a technical name for a band of robbers that would have carried over, then come back up and after the flood. But I don't think there's any evidence in the Nephilim for a local flood. And Dr. Austin and I were talking before the question and answer period. The flood is kind of like creation. God could not have said it any more forcefully than he did that it was universal flood. I mean, just heaps, one universal phrase upon another. And then when you compare that with 2 Peter's comparison of the judgment of the flood and judgment at the end of the age, the fact that God promised that he would never again deal with mankind in that way, well, if it was just a terrible local flood, we've had plenty of terrible local floods and that have killed thousands of people. And so all the biblical evidence I believe, points to a universal flood. And that really has been one of the first cracks in the wall of conservative Christianity to begin to consent to a partial flood. I think it's a major compromise.
What is or are the chief problems facing creation-based scientific research? I think the chief problem is the faith of believers, to be completely honest with you. I think what people like Steve and myself feel most directly is insufficient financial sums necessary to accomplish the tasks that are before us. I talked about the graduate students who are up and coming and getting finished and getting into the field. Well, we don't have any way to support them. We don't have any way to give them jobs so that they can support their family. As a parent, I kind of feel that these people coming up with graduate degrees now are kind of like my children. I have some responsibility to help support them. I have Todd Wood. I was able to get him a limited stipend to come in to work with me there at Bryan College. It's really an embarrassingly small stipend for someone with his ability, but he felt led by the Lord to take advantage of that and work with me a few years. And in that stipend is because a particular family, just one individual, saw fit to donate the necessary money to make that happen. My research money comes only out of the generosity of the Lord's people. Not too many grants available to creation researchers. There are some creationist or some Christian organizations that will supply money to these sorts of things from time to time, but for the most part, it's individuals giving money, $10, $20, and that sort of thing at a time, that is the basis for the research that I'm able to do. With an increasing number of graduate students coming out of graduate school, very difficult for them to get positions in secular universities under natural circumstances. God can make anything happen. What looks like, from my perspective, and this is why I prefaced it this way, from my perspective and probably from Steve's as well, it seems as if we have very few resources available, especially monetary resources. Steve was talking about this rate project, which is you're talking $250,000 to do. I mean, it's awfully expensive to date a rock. I had never spent that much on I dated my wife. I don't understand why you're doing that much on a dating of a rock. But it is extremely expensive to do this. But we have to, in order to figure out what the patterns are, in order to reinterpret them, we have to do the dating ourselves to know what the patterns are. Because we cannot necessarily, I don't want this to be understood incorrectly, we can't trust that the unbelievers who are wanting to see things a particular way are telling us everything they're finding. I know of many instances where people invested the money necessary to date and find the geologic age of a rock, got the answer and went, that's not right. And so they never mentioned it. They never publish it. We don't know what the pattern is because the pattern is being suppressed. So we have to do it ourselves, which is terribly expensive. What Todd Wood is doing is working on genome research, which is mapping genetic makeup of organisms. That's an expensive process. It's becoming easier and easier, but it's an expensive process, requires supercomputing capabilities and all sorts of things like that are very expensive. And creationist organizations aren't putting resources in that kind of direction. The church is not putting resources in that kind of direction. So it looks like a lack of money is probably our biggest problem. But that having been said, we have a God who has all the resources of the universe. And so ultimately, I see our lack is really the result of a lack of faith and faithfulness of the believers in allowing his resources to be used for his honor and his glory. But that's what I feel and what I perceive is sort of a money need to support these young students, to support the research that we do. People have been gracious. I get plane tickets from a retired United Airlines pilot so that I can go to some of these places with limit. I mean, people have been incredible, but that's, you know, we're working on shoestring budgets to make this happen. Fortunately, I'm a theoretical paleontologist, which means I can do all my work with very little money investment. So I'm kind of a cheapskate, but I seem to be encouraging people to do research that's very expensive. So all these people that I'm kind of wanting to father need lots and lots of money. I got one guy looking for a job. He's a paleontologist. There's no Christian college in this country that I know of that has a major in geology that believes in young age creationism. So there's no job opportunities, even in Christian colleges. The only ones that have such majors are old age creationist colleges, Christian colleges that won't hire young age creationists. So that's the little challenge we have right now. But ultimately, we serve a God who can serve all those needs. So it's my lack of faith in Him that is ultimately why things look weak on the money side of things.
There may be another angle the questioner had in mind. What is the major research challenge? One thing, maybe Kurt would agree with this, is we don't need the ultimate super proof against evolution. What we need is to build a better mousetrap. We need a creationist biology. We need a creationist geology. We need a creationist radioisotope interpretation of rocks. We need a whole bunch of things like that. Another good question. Here's my question. Why postulate rapid decay if parent radioactive materials, of parent radioactive materials early on, I suppose, during creation week? Is it not co-creation or co-deposition of parent and daughter materials a plausible explanation? Probably both explanations are what may explain many rock systems. I'll give you an example of why I believe that there was a lot of a radioactive, what should I say, transmutation during creation week. There are some crystals inside of rock which we think are creation week rock. We know there's creation week rock because on day three of creation, what? We had a rocky continent exposed out of the oceans, right? So where is that rock? Well, we can dig into the center or core of the continent. We can find deep down those granitic basement rocks, so-called Precambrian basement rocks under a large part of the continent appear to have that characteristic of being creation week rock, and probably by creation week day three. But in the mineral phases of those rocks, we find zircon, which is a high uranium mineral that has also large quantities of lead, 207, 206. Also has high thorium content and has high lead, 208. And so the combination of the small mineral phases with large quantities of what appear to be decay products from the radioactive decay chain, plus the high helium content of those minerals, leads me to believe that there was a significant amount of radioisotope transmutation, if you want to use the word. I don't like the word decay during creation week. That has negative connotation. But anyway, so there's things like that. I know a mineral, and personally analyzed a mineral from the Beartooth Gneiss in Wyoming. The Beartooth Range is thought to be the oldest rock in the 48 states. It has these little crystals in it called titanite, calcium titanium silicates, loaded with uranium, loaded with rare earth elements, samarium, and we see the radioactive decay daughter associated with it. So it appears like these are Creation Week rocks that have been subjected to a huge amount of radioisotope decay. The other evidence of huge amount of radioisotope decay in these rocks is, well, not just the parent-daughter relationship close in individual mineral grains, and not just the helium content, which is helium is formed by radioisotope decay in the lead, the formation of lead, it's alpha nuclei. Helium is generated, it throws off alpha particles which become helium, essentially helium nuclei that become helium atoms. The other evidence is radioisotope decay halos. These are called radio halos. And around some zircon crystals in biotite, for example, you can see a halo effect. And it's a radioactive disintegration a zone that's caused by the high energy radioactive decay. And so those three things lead me to believe that fission, go fission tracks in some of those rocks too. So there's physical evidence of radioactive isotope decay. The halos and fission tracks are the primary evidence. And but then there's evidence that the parent and daughter have been deposited together. And a good example of that is strontium. Almost every strontium deposit that is associated with rubidium that can be used with rubidium strontium dating has a major amount of strontium 87 in it, which is freely admitted by everyone to not have formed by radioactive decay of rubidium 87. So there's obviously, and then there's modern examples or modern volcanoes, and some of the good examples on the north rim of Grand Canyon that I've dated. This lava flow spilled over the rim of the Grand Canyon down the river, blocked the river. It's obviously been very recent. I used the rubidium strontium isochron method to date the suite of volcanic centers on the north rim in the western Grand Canyon, about 1.3 billion years old, for these what appear to be ice age lava flows that obviously post-date all of the stratified fossil-bearing layers in the canyon. So in that case, we've had the parent and daughter being erupted by these volcanoes having the appearance of age. So both are probably explanations for radioisotopes. So we need to generate the explanation for how this occurred. If God accelerated radioisotope transmutation during creation week, what was the effect of it? Was that to generate a lot of heat in the earth to tectonically deform the surface of the earth to create the continents? That might be a wonderful way to do it. Now, there's all kinds of other things to think about, exactly what was going on. Most of the granite rocks in the basement show evidence of being hot, and we still got hot batholiths around. So there's another good question.
Is the six-day position gaining or losing ground in American churches? I think that there has been at least in the denominations with which I am more familiar, the Presbyterian Church in America and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, there's been a resurgence of a newfound commitment to six-day creation. And I'm very encouraged by that. Just as I also believe that what these brothers are doing has reached a new level of maturity from, say, where ICR was 20 years ago or something like that. And all this, I believe, bodes well for the future if God continues to bless this. In light of that, though, I think that we need to be patient. We need to understand that, as I said this afternoon, we basically, until this present generation of ministers that are being trained in some places, all the rest were taught that it really isn't an issue. I was taught that 30-something years ago in seminary. And so I believe we have an education process that's very important, both in the church, exegetically and theologically, and then to continue to get Christians exposed to the work of the young earth scientists and the constructs that are every bit as explanatory of the physical model and are consistent with the scripture. But we need prayerfully to do this, and we need to be patient. But we need also to continue to talk and to get literature into people's hands. And then you do need to support these men and the schools. What Dr. Wise said is it's true, and it's a crying shame. I don't know of a conservative, traditional college that has any real commitment to six-day creationism. They'll have to have some six-day creationists in their science departments, but and so those of you that are alumni or you have your children in these Christian colleges, then you need to be speaking up and encouraging in the only ways that colleges can be encouraged. Withhold or not withholding funds from schools that, not that they have to have all six-day creationists, but if they're going to be biased against the position and say, we're going to take our kids and our money and go elsewhere. I do not know about Bryan College where you teach, so we won't get into that. But again, in my circles, Covenant College, for example, has six-day creationists on the faculty that I know in the chemistry department and other departments, but that would not be in any way an exclusive commitment of the college, and they don't have a major in geology as far as I know. That's the other problem.
Work with them.
Okay, I'm the one on the panel that's worked the closest with the geoscience research and the Loma Linda people since I'm over there right next to them. Wonderful fellowship. There are some unusual Adventist points of theology, but once you get beyond those, we have so much in common. It's incredible. Most Adventists believe in inanimate matter in existence for long periods of time before creation week began. And I find that offensive. I think it doesn't agree with Exodus and for in 6 days the Lord created heaven and earth, the sea and all that in it is and rested on the seventh day. But that's a minor point because we find ourselves in agreement with interpreting fossil bearing layers and so much other geologic features. So we've had some wonderful correspondence. And you may look at that journal called Origins. It's an excellent journal. Loma Linda University, they have a PhD program in paleontology, and it's California-based. What do you call it? Yeah, paleobiology.
They called it paleobiology, but it isn't.
Okay, whatever. They have a program where they study all kinds of interesting things, such as Green River fossil fish, and they're doing some sedimentology and paleontology work. And it's then they have Geoscience Research Institute, which is four or five dedicated scientists who are dealing with these origins-related questions. They're doing some rather deep questions. Some of the best work that's been done on the petrified forest at Yellowstone has been done by Geoscience Research Institute. Some of the work that's been done on the Green River Formation, the fossil fish in Wyoming, that's been done by Adventists. The Adventists had a significant impact on the modern creation movement because of George McKee Price and elsewhere. So they've had a good impact on the doctrine of creation generally.
That having been said, there are good, strong creationists at that institution, but it's there's a very high tension between those folks and the rest of Loma Linda. Loma Linda, dominated by that graduate, that medical school, would rather have the young age creationists drop off the face of the earth. Okay, I mean, it's, this is an embarrassment. There is a huge tension. You need only talk to those folks out there to recognize that. There's a lot of tension. The church, the SDA church, has traditionally been young age creationists, but there's an increasing insurgence within it of those who would argue otherwise. But that still is, the reason it's not a paleontology or a true paleobiology department is because it's taught by, this parenthetical note, it's taught by biologists and geologists, but not paleontologists. So you don't actually get paleontology by teaching, by getting taught biology and geology. There is a need to actually get a paleontological perspective, not just a biological and geological. But there are some good biologists, good young age creationist biologists, good young, and I call that for young life biologists and young life geologists there. And so it's a young age creationist can feel somewhat comfortable there if they stay away from certain areas of the university. Bryan College, there's one person I know of on campus in the faculty who does not believe in young age creationism. Otherwise, I'm the director of origins research at Bryan College, so it's rather strongly biased towards young age creationism across the board. The Bible department, almost to a person, holds that position. The entire science department holds the position of young age creationism. But you have places like Bob Jones University, Liberty University, Cedarville, Clearwater. There aren't too many. We're only talking probably total, you know, the fingers on two hands are going to pretty much take it for liberal arts colleges, Christian liberal arts colleges, who hold strongly that kind of a position. Most, I'd say 95% of Christian academia holds a position against young age creationism. 95%, I would say, of Christian academia, now, Christian academia, is against young age creationism. Most of them believe that the earth is old and God used evolution in some way or another to bring things into being. That's the predominant position.
Percentages probably aren't much better for the conservative seminaries either.
Yeah, I was in a conservative seminary a few years ago, or what most people would understand to be a conservative seminary in a conservative denomination. It was an origins conference, and they decided that since they were talking about origins and talking about young age creationism, they really needed a young age creationist, but they couldn't find one in their seminary or any of their colleges, this entire denomination. So they had me come in from the outside to present the young age creation position. That was the most antagonistic, I felt, position I've been ever in my life. But that, if I were to mention the denomination, and everybody would associate it with conservatism. And it just blew me away. I didn't expect this. This was pretty amazing to me. But yes, most seminaries are in the same situation. It's sometimes possible to find colleges where the Bible department is a young age creationist and the science department isn't, and vice versa, where you can get the science department believes in young age creation and the Bible department doesn't. It's very rare to find both of them that are in agreement on young age creationism. I really enjoy that about Bryan. But then again, that isn't embracing diversity, is it? Oh, well. Please discuss your Behrman research and coming conference. What are the implications of this? Yeah, of course, the study of Brahmins, the created kinds, is a new field. It's only 10 years old, but it's growing. We have probably, I think it was 6 years ago, we started an internet study group where we built up to about a half dozen. Last year we had a conference where we brought in a number of numbers and trained some more people in it. So now we have about 40 people, 40 biologists, professional biologists who are involved with this, which is very, very exciting. The conference next year, again, we hope to make available to anyone who wants to come. And that will again be in part purpose to teach people how to do baraminology, how to recognize the created kinds, and then go about the study of them. We have a small task ahead of us. We have to rename and reclassify all the organisms of the earth. You know, anybody want beetles? 250,000 species there. Anybody interested? Okay. We've got the flies, the diptera. Anybody interested in the diptera? We have nobody in the diptera. You know, several hundred thousand species there, and so it goes. That's the task we have before us. So 40 people is it's a whole lot smaller than what we need, but it's exciting because I've never seen this many creationists working on one project in all my life. So this is pretty cool. What's its significance? So what? I think it can be seen, it's a microcosm. There's a group, I won't identify who they are and where they are. There's a group of folks who don't especially like baraminology, who feel that what they should do is identify created kinds, but otherwise just kind of note where they exist on the conventional classification scheme. And don't shake the boat, don't change the classification, don't just identify the created kinds. They don't call them that, but just identify them. Now, I have problems with that position because, in fact, if within created kinds, God created the potential or the ability to change within that created kind, to produce new species and to adapt and that sort of thing for the preservation of the created kind, but that created kind is distinct and separate from other created kinds, then God created all these created kinds in a particular pattern. Okay, if you now kind of pull the created kind into a point and just see it as a dab of color, that if you looked up from above and saw all the dabs of color, each dab representing a special created kind in the original creation, I would suggest that those dabs of color, when seen in that fashion, would show and display an incredibly beautiful picture. That it's every thread of a tapestry. But if you do not see the created kinds as distinct units, you will never see the tapestry. It will be completely destroyed by the evolutionary tree of relationship that you're sticking this created kinds on. And I think for us to understand God as he truly is, we need to see the creation from his perspective. We need to, as much as possible, wherever possible and whenever possible, see the pattern he put in those things that are made. He put that pattern there for us to see so that we would see him, we'd be drawn closer to him and get to know him better. And I think one of the most important things about creationism, in my opinion, is as we begin to see things as he wants us to see them, we will improve our understanding of God. That should draw us closer to him. And as we're drawn closer to him, we'll be in a much better position to minister to the other people in the world. The closer we get to God, the more our heart is broken by the needs of the people around us. The closer we get to God, the more we're willing to allow him to work through us. So why do I want to see the created pattern? It's so that I can be better used by him to share that created pattern with other people and to share what's most important, which is the gospel, with these other people. And one thing is identifying created kinds, identifying the rocks of the flood, the evidence, to look across the Grand Canyon and to recognize that is a mile deep, if you wish to look at it this way, cemetery of organisms killed as a direct result of man's sin. It's an awesome thing to stand there and to recognize that this is a direct consequence of man's sin. This is how God feels about sin. But in the same sense, when you step up to the side of the edge of the Grand Canyon. Don't step off. I guess you could come to see him quicker that way. if you step up to the edge of the Grand Canyon, what strikes you first and probably most impressively is the incredible beauty. And what's amazing to me is that even in judging man's sin, God can't help but create beauty out of it. And I see this in my flowers bloom over a landscape that, there was beautiful forest over there, but now there is a special beauty that's associated with that recovering landscape, that God creates beauty. And see, if those who go through life and don't see God's hand in those things that are made, in biology, in geology, in astronomy, how can they possibly come to know Him as He wants them to know Him? They can't see that. And what an wonderful opportunity we have to point to God if we can see those things that are made. So I really got off the track here, but in general, the exciting things and some of the most exciting things in creationism are pointing God out to the people of the world. And to see God ourselves, I mean, I just have a whole lot of fun walking out and seeing every day a little bit more of God in those things that are made.
On next. Okay, do you have any comment or can you briefly summarize North Carolina geology in relationship to plate tectonics and the flood? Another good question, and you definitely want to know about your homeland. If you don't know what's in your backyard, somebody asks you, and you can't answer that, but you say, "I know what's going on in Grand Canyon." That doesn't probably just sit well with your neighbor. So I'll tell you how I'd answer it. I'd say, well, you look at the Appalachian Mountains, and what do you see? A whole bunch of buckled and folded mountains. Caused probably by east-west compression, perhaps Africa pushed into North America, and then the pull apart generated a rift basin and ultimately the Atlantic Ocean as a result. But anyway, the compressional mountains, then you see that's the Appalachian chain, goes down into Alabama all the way up in Newfoundland and over in the Caledonian area and Europe. It essentially is all one buckled belt. Okay, that it has similar types of strata, sandstones grading up into carbonate and rock salt deposits, grading up into red sandstones, into coal beds, into other shales and things. That whole section of strata has been warped and bent by this compression. And I would put that in the middle of the flood, somewhere toward the middle of the flood, this rifting is occurring. And at the same time, a whole bunch of lavas are forming in this Newark or Triassic kind of situation that's off of here. And that creates what's called the Piedmont. And the Piedmont is slightly dipped, but a beveled strata. The Appalachian is strongly folded and deeply beveled strata. And then you have the coastal plain, which is probably the post-flood result. The late flood is probably the retreat of waters off of the Piedmont, and the water probably in the post-flood period sat about the Piedmont over a large part of the continental shelf here and over North Carolina. So has anybody found shark's teeth in the sand? Okay, things like that. Probably post-flood. Okay, good. So probably there's some post-flood life forms that got fossilized here occasionally. And then what's happened is the ice age and the ocean has retreated, essentially exposing the continental shelf here. And then the ocean level has risen slightly since the time of Abraham, ice age before Abraham. And then now we've slightly flooded a little bit, leaving the Barrier Island complex offshore. You've got the plain or the coastal plain, and then you've got the Piedmont, and then you've got the Appalachian. I think that's kind of explained it. I think most of the strata in the core of the Appalachian Mountains profoundly flood-related, and you see evidence of large log mats depositing trees and fossil deposits with crinoids, and you see broad, widespread sandstone layers, and things that are just extraordinarily unique in relationship to flood. So the flood, then you see the mid-flood folding of the mountains, the beveling of this area in the retreat of the flood, forming the Piedmont and a fault basin with the Piedmont, and then the ocean sitting over the Piedmont, or essentially the shoreline at about the Piedmont, and then this coastal plain wedge, essentially a wedge of sediment thickening out to the Atlantic Ocean. That's kind of my thoughts on that. Anybody want to talk about that more? That's a big subject. Also, you know, you might use this for economic benefit, like where would I look for oil and some of those kind of things. But that's, you might challenge your neighbor if you see fossils, strata, those kind of things. Think about North Carolina geology. I wish I knew more about North Carolina geology. I could maybe help. I grew up learning geology in California, and then I came out for 4 years in Pennsylvania, so that's as close as I got to really deeply dabbling into North Carolina geology.
This ties in to part of Dr. Wise's previous answer. As long as I accept as a Christian that God created the world, why does it matter whether I believe God used evolution or not? Well, in the first place, I would assume the questioner doesn't believe that both positions may be true. Postmodernism might believe that, but we must accept that there's a true position, and we must also accept that whatever the Bible says about origins is true. And that still doesn't settle the interpretation of the Bible, but it does assert the authority of the Bible. And so it does matter if the Bible speaks to it. We both are not right. We both may be wrong, but we're both not right. Two opposites can never both be true. But furthermore, then, after what I did with you quickly this afternoon, you need to understand is that we then get into some hermeneutical problems, and that is, how do we approach the Bible? And one of the things that bothers me greatly about the biblical constructs that would make room then for a diversity of old earth scientific constructs is the principles of interpretation and the cavalier attitude of dealing with the text of Scripture, which I think actually is much more serious than the theories themselves that certain Christian theologians want to put forth. Because, and I'll point this out tomorrow afternoon, the method itself has no breaks. It's only the personal convictions of the particular exegete or scholar that's going to cause him to draw the line. Genesis 1 is figurative and not literal. We've already seen from that a massive hemorrhaging with respect to the flood. I don't personally know anybody that doesn't hold Genesis 1 that, I'm going to get my don'ts correct here, that also doesn't believe in a local flood. They just, one falls with the other. But then what's to stop when you realize that Genesis 2 and 3 have really more highly figurative language than Genesis 1? God is a potter forming man from the dust and breathing life into him. Or such things as talking snakes. Are these also fables to explain our faith system? And we can just take that straight through the Bible. Is it any more difficult to believe that Jesus made water from wine than it is that God dried the earth out immediately when he separated the waters from the earth? And so there's a system at work here that is very important. And then another reason it's important is, as I also said this afternoon, the pervasive commentary of the Bible itself to Genesis 1 as a literal account. In fact, I'm willing to say that the doctrine of creation, a six-day creation, is probably one of the most well-attested doctrines in the Bible, much better attested than the doctrine of the Trinity. And so, and then God uses it that way. It's a constant challenge. When you read in the Psalms and the Prophets, God puts a high premium on the supernatural character of revelation, of creation, to prove that he is the true God, to show his ownership, to show his sovereignty, that he is to be worshipped. Revelation 4:11, one of the primary reasons that God is worshipped in heaven is that he is the creator of all things. And so there are a lot of practical, and that gets back then to what Dr. Wise had to say. Our desire ought to be to see the glory of God, to enjoy God, and to glorify God to those around us. And I believe that God has given us, has created in this way, and given us this revelation, that he might be most honored and glorified. And thus it's important that we approach it in that manner.
Thank you.